51551. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our email is miriam@rte.ie, or you can tweet us to @MiriamOcal. Well, next up this morning, have a listen to this. Got a feeling rain is over. That's the voice of Fran O'Toole, lead singer with the Miami, one of the most popular and successful show bands in Ireland in the mid-1970s. With 7 number one songs, the band enjoyed a massive following north and south of the border as they endlessly toured the country. But disaster struck, and on July the 31st, 1975, the anniversary was just this week, when returning from a performance in Banbridge in County Down, three members of the band, Fran O'Toole, Tony Geraghty and Brian McCoy, were murdered by loyalist paramilitaries on the side of the road in what became known as the Miami Show Band Massacre. One of the band members, who was also shot that night and almost died, is here with me this morning. Good morning, Stephen Travers. Thanks for being here. And take me back firstly, Stephen, will you, to how you joined the Miami Show Band?
Well, I joined, like most people, to earn a living, and because no matter how, you know, idealistic you are about your music, you still have to pay the mortgage and, you know, put bread on the table. And I quickly realised that these guys were fabulous musicians, and it was an honour to play with them.
Remind me and other people how big the Miami Show Band were at that time in the mid-70s.
Well, the halcyon days of the show bands had passed, really, towards the end of the 60s. The Miami had been going since the very early 60s, and about 66, 67, I think it was, they split and formed, and some of the guys went off and formed the Sands, and the Miami continued on, and they recruited, very cleverly, they recruited all the best of the young beat group musicians, and that was Fran O'Toole. He joined, Fran and Paul Ashford, they joined, and they were really popular, so it was a clever strategic move to bring them in. By the time that I joined in 75, it was no longer called the Miami Show Band. It was actually just called the Miami. There were bands in America like Chicago and people like that, so they thought they'd get away, you know, with that sort of ambiguity. I think Fran was trying to sort of bring the band back to his beat group days. They were called the Chosen Few at the time when he joined, so that's what he was training. That's why he recruited people like great guitar player like Tony Geraghty, and I probably was the final piece of the jigsaw to bring it back there. Yeah,
and he was hugely popular, wasn't he?
He was the pop star. Girls had his picture in the over the beds and all that kind of business, and I remember in particular, if you stopped at a show, we'd call it a shop stop on the way to a gig, pull into some small town or whatever, and you'd be in the shop for all of 10 seconds and he'd be surrounded by, you know, all of the girls in the town or the women in the shop. He was the David Cassidy, I suppose, of Ireland, yeah.
And you were a mixed band, weren't you, from different backgrounds?
We were. I actually didn't know the religions of the guys until after they were killed, because it didn't matter. You know, the only currency was, you know, can he play? That was it.
So you were touring, obviously, up in the north when this happened. You were only in the band a month, is that right, Stephen?
About 6 weeks.
So where were you playing on the night that this happened? Where had you been playing?
Well, we had done the Monday and Tuesday, I think it was, at the Galway Races. And then we came home, then we went off to Banbridge to play the Wednesday night. It was, you know, summertime, middle of summer, so a lot of kids around.
So was it on your way back down from Banbridge?
Well, we had, after we finished the gig, it was very unusual. Normally you get a cup of tea or whatever after a gig and before you head off, and the roadie, Brian McGuire, we leave before him, but for some strange reason in Banbridge in the Castle Ballroom, they were serving Irish stew. This was the first time I'd ever got Irish stew after a gig. And I was also reading a book, and we were taking our time because there was no rush. It was a relatively short journey back to Dublin from Banbridge. So Brian McGuire had left with the gear just a couple of minutes before us. So on our way back, we could see Brian's taillights. And on our way back, we were just flagged down by this man with a red torch. and Brian McCoy, who was one of our lads, was driving our personnel van, and he said, just a checkpoint ahead, lads, we have to pull in. So we took no notice of it, and when they stopped us, they told us to pull into the side and all get out of the minibus. It was a Volkswagen minibus, and line up facing the ditch. Was a field in front of us with about a 10-foot drop down into the field. We were on the road, and they told us to put our hands on our heads, and we were lined up with our hands on our heads, and the soldiers there, they were all in uniform, UDR uniform at the beginning that I saw, and they were all obviously pointing their weapons at us, but they were very friendly and they were joking. And you wonder afterwards in hindsight how somebody can joke knowing that they're going to kill you in a few minutes, but they were joking. And then they asked us our names, for our names and addresses, and then this man appeared on the scene, whether he was there and we didn't see him or whether he came in the car that pulled up shortly after we pulled in, but he was he had different colour fatigues on, a lighter colour, and he was he had a very crisp English accent. I mean, I had been a trainee broker at Lloyd's in London, and I knew the difference between, you know, the accent. And immediately that he arrived, he changed the order. He said, I want their names and dates of birth. And so Brian McCoy, who was from the north, he nudged my elbow. We had our hands on our heads. So he nudged my elbow with his elbow, and he said, don't worry, Steve, this is British Army. And the indication was that we'd be away quickly because they were far more sort of professional. And it was just clearly this man was in charge, and everybody, the joking stopped, and everybody became more professional when he was giving the orders. And I treated the whole thing as an adventure. I actually took my hands down because I heard somebody at the back of the minibus, and I thought the only thing that we ever carried in the back of the minibus were our guitars, Tony Geraghty's guitar and mine. He had a Gibson 335, and I had a very unusual see-through plexiglass bass, a Dan Armstrong, and we were very precious about them, you know, so we wouldn't let it go off with the gear. And when I heard them at the back of the van, I actually took my hands down and walked back and said, can you be careful with that, please? And the soldier, there was two soldiers there, and one of them pointed at the small, like a school bag, little school case, the brown ones that we used to have years ago. And he said, what's in that? I said, it's effects pedals, again, which is unusual for a bass player. I had an octave divider, and I had a wah-wah pedal. And he said, are there any valuables in it? I said, no. And he actually turned me around and he hit me very hard in the kidneys and knocked me back in line. And this time, instead of being on Brian's left, I was now on Brian's right. And very shortly after that, we didn't realise that there was two men actually planting a bomb underneath the driver's seat. We wouldn't, you know, we weren't supposed to know about this. Everything else was to take our attention away from that. And while they were planting it, the bomb went off and killed the two of those men. And it actually blew us into the air because we were standing very close to the van. And I remember trying to get a purchase on my, with my feet, but I found that I was in the air. I was trying to run, but I was actually in the air. And they tell me that I was shot in the air. I'm not sure, but I crashed down into the field and the other guys crashed down after me, on top of me. And the next thing I remember, there was an awful lot of gunfire at this stage, and with automatic weapons, and it was very loud. It's literally the onomatopoeic sound. It was like bang. You couldn't describe it anymore. Very loud bang. And I remember somebody, at least one person, I thought it was one person, putting their arms under my, trying to lift me up and drag me, and somebody dragged me a little further into the field. Now, it may have been two of the lads, but I got the impression it was one of them. And but I collapsed. I had been shot at that stage. I was hit with what they call a dum-dum bullet, which is an explosive bullet in the right hip. And it went and it exploded inside, and it came out under my left arm. And then I heard the other guys, our lads, being murdered, and they were actually crying. One of them, it was, you know, they're terrified, obviously, but they weren't just content to kill them. They shot Fran 22 times. About 15 of those bullets was in his face, and all the lads were killed very close to me. I pretended to be dead. And I remember my cheek against the grass, which is like almost like a dewy. It was a beautiful morning. It was about 2:30, and it was about a half moon outside. And there was a lot of fire on the road at this stage as well, because the ditch had caught fire and the van was on fire. And I heard a man walking around, and he was kicking the bodies to see if they were alive. And it came towards me, and I had this dilemma: do I get up and beg for my life, or will I stay where I am? And I was lucky, I just stayed very quiet. And as he approached me, I heard some man on the road with a northern accent, and he shouted down, "Come on, I got those bastards with dum-dums, they're dead." And for some, you know, reason, he just turned and walked away, and I was steeling myself. I was counting his steps, and I was trying to figure out, you know, if he does fire into me, that will I be able to pretend, you know, not cry out or whatever. But he didn't. He just went away. And I heard Des calling me. Des Lee, or Des McAlay, but we called him Des Lee. He had escaped uninjured, and he was hiding under the bushes. But they were now on fire, so he had to get out of there. So these people left, and he asked me if I was okay, and he got up onto the road, and he actually stopped a car. Well, he stopped a lorry first, and the lorry wouldn't take him, and he was probably terrified. He didn't know who Des was. And then a car with a young man and woman actually brought him into Newry Police Station, and I was with the lads for about 45 minutes before a helicopter came in and sort of gave the okay for them to come in. They took me off to hospital.
Did you think you were going to die?
It's not something. Everything is about survival, and I've often said, you know, the minute I was shot, I was getting better. Your body. I didn't obviously didn't realize I was shot, because I mean, I saw the state of the guys, and I actually counted my fingers to see, you know, I thought we'd be playing tomorrow night, you know, because that situation does weird things. It does weird things to you. You don't accept it. I couldn't find any blood on myself. I clicked my feet together to see if I had my legs. I sat up to see if my back was broken. I knew something bad had happened. What I noticed was that my stomach was very extended. I had internal bleeding. I had a lot of internal bleeding, but there was no blood outside, so I was convinced I wasn't shot. But I went over to the side of the field, and I had to try to cling on to a branch, try to get some relief. My lung had collapsed, and I couldn't breathe properly. But I put that down to the fact that the man had hit me. And even when they brought me into the hospital, they asked me what happened. And I told him I fell through a ditch, you know. I suppose it's some kind of protective mechanism or something that you go into this. It was, as I say, you're getting better. It's the people around you, you know. My wife Anne, you can imagine, she was 21 years of age, and She was told that morning, she was brought up, and the minute she arrived, the first thing she was told when she arrived was that I was dead. So it was matter of fact for these people. It's an experience for a young girl like that. So, you know, while I was getting better, everybody else was going through a terrible time, you know.
When you waited for that 40 minutes, mm-hmm. when Des went and got help and came back, you said you were there.
Yeah.
With your other band members who were dead.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Well, I dealt with it by, first of all, convincing myself that I was very lucky. And I decided, you know, that I would just put it behind me. Everybody said, you know, that we didn't see any, we didn't have any counselling or anything like that, you know, that we just, you were told get on with it, you know. What I didn't realise was that my career was gone. It was, nobody really could afford to have, no matter, you know, how accomplished you were in your instrument, nobody could afford to have that type of history on their stage. And I had been the hotshot bass player up until that night, and, you know, I could have name my price for any of the bands at the time, but after that we were untouchable. Des and I, our careers were gone, but we didn't see it like that. But when I went to London, nobody knew me, and I was playing 15 nights a week. I'd play three times on a Sunday and twice every day in jazz clubs and everything, and it was great. But I eventually knew that I had to confront this. And it was the 30th anniversary that I actually began to confront it. And then I wrote the book with Neil Featherstone Hall in 2007. And that was picked up by Hollywood now, and they're going to make a movie.
And I'll go back to that in a moment. Remind people, Stephen, of the three people from your band who were murdered that day. Obviously Fran, but...
Fran O'Toole was the lead singer and keyboard player. Brian McCoy was the trumpet player and singer as well. The lad that I was closest to was Tony Garrett. He was from Crumlin, and he was a delightful person. He was an absolutely fabulous classical and jazz musician as well. If we had a night off, we'd go out together, and he even came down to Carrickenshore on, you know, if we had two days off, we'd go down and we'd jam with all the other guys and lots of, you know, friends and all that. We were very close, so that was particularly difficult for me to lose him.
This may sound like a harsh question, and I don't want it to, but do you or have you ever suffered from survivor's guilt?
I think the closest I can say is sometimes... I think that the guys who died were the lucky ones. It's, sometimes it's very difficult to know what it is that hurts you. But at the same time, you know, you're hurting inside. And I suppose maybe that's survivor's guilt, I don't know, but sometimes you just want to be with them. And to share in it that you didn't deserve to be the one to survive. By the very nature of the instrument that I played, you're a sideman. That's all I ever wanted to be, was, you know, a bass player. That's what he does, you know. He's not the front guy jumping around the place, and I never ever wanted to be in the limelight. But I thought, you know, if I don't do it, then they'll be forgotten, and I don't want them forgotten, and I don't want the lessons not to be there.
You said you had no counselling. That's exactly. Have you had any counselling since then?
No, just because we're taking a case, so I had to be assessed. At that time, we were assessed to see what condition we were in, because it was a criminal injuries case back about 1978 or something like that. But I was assessed recently for the current case. And I thought that, you know, that the psychologist would say, well, you know, you handled it very well, and congratulations, you're a tough guy. But what actually happened, I said at the very worst they'd say that I had post-traumatic stress, because there were issues. And I was diagnosed as having the same type of condition that you would have if somebody came out of a concentration camp. It's like you go into into a situation as one person, you come out a completely different person, which was a surprise. But it wasn't a surprise to my wife or to people that know me, you know, that I had completely changed. But you don't know that about yourself until, you know, until you're actually pointed out and all of the things. And there are a lot of things, you know. If I'm in a crowd, I see faces very big, I focus almost like fisheye lens that I see, and I thought this was perfectly natural, but obviously it isn't.
And interestingly, Brian McCoy, one of your band members who was murdered on that day, his father was in the Orange Order, wasn't he? I
mean, he was the Grand Master of the Tyrone Orange Lodge, yeah. It was actually, if you look at it, you stand back and look at it, it was a brilliant plan. The reason that it happened was the British authorities were very unhappy with the security arrangements south of the border, and they decided that if they could force the Irish government to have stringent checks, the same as we would have, the minute you drove into the north, you would be stopped by the paratroops or some regiment, and that could happen on any road or wherever, and you'd be searched or whatever. Now, they knew the Miami, but once you came back into the south, you might meet a guard or whatever. So if there was, say, terrorist activity in the north, if the IRA blew someplace up, coming back down, once they got inside the border, you know, they were relatively home free. But so they decided that if they could frame the most trusted of the people who travelled up and down, that they would be able to say to the world, no, well, whatever we do now, you know, it's warranted, because we've, you know, these guys who everybody trusted were carrying bombs, so nobody would have known about the roadblock. We would have gone down the road, they would have waved us off and said thanks very much. It would have blown up, and you know, people would have said that we were terrorists. You can imagine that. And so not only would we be dead, but our families would be disgraced, you know. That's actually, for me, more frightening than the thought of being killed.
Three men were convicted for the murders, weren't they, in the end? But as we now know, there was lots of collusion. Once again, British security forces were involved in the murder of your three friends in the van.
Yes, and the HET report that into the Miami incident basically gave us a smoking gun, but I feel that the HET also fudged and covered over the British Army involvement. I wasn't happy with that, so they actually began to make me feel as if to doubt my own eyes and ears, and I was worried about that. And they suggested that the British Army officer had been brought into the narrative, you know, later on at some stage. And I said to my wife, you know, when did I actually start? And she gave me a cutting from an interview that was done while I was in hospital, where I'm actually talking about it. So there is, and I gave it to the HET, I scanned it and gave it, and they still wouldn't put it into the report. So that's what annoys me about that.
But you are taking a case now, aren't you, against the British state?
We are, and I'd like to emphasise that we're not taking anybody to court, and we're not trying to have anybody punished. We're actually taking the system, you know, we're taking the system to court.
But it's also, as you said, based on your own book, going to be turned into a Hollywood film now, the story of that horrible night.
It is, but again, you know, it's when somebody focuses on the incident, they're learning more about the perpetrators, as opposed to if they look at the individuals, then they learn more about the, you know, the loss that Ireland suffered on that night, the loss of these great people that we miss so much.
You spoke there about how the condition you're meant to have now is that you're a very different person to the person you were before that night. Is the old Stephen still there, or did the Stephen you were disappear given the horror of what you went through?
Well, the official term for it is called enduring personality change. I had never heard of that before. I'd like to think that there is something there, hopefully there is. My wife still loves me, you know. I do realise now that there were massive changes in my life. And that's a difficult thing to face up to, because you think you're still, you know, if I play now, which I rarely do, but if I play, I don't do it for a living now, but if I play with Johnny Feen, I'm 16 again, you know, or I'm 17 again, because we play all the old 60s Kings and Beatles and Rolling Stones and all that type of thing. And that, it's during those times that we're aquaplaning, and that we're actually, that's what, the playing is perhaps the closest I can come to the old Stephen.
Were you full of anger Or were you full of sadness? Did you look at life differently afterwards?
I began to think that there was something wrong with me. I wasn't ever able to be angry. And even when I met the UVF and they at a secret meeting in Belfast in a church, it was like something from the Da Vinci Code, I wanted to be angry with them. And I couldn't feel angry. I couldn't be angry with them. But I think more than writing the book, I think it was the screenplay that gradually began to wear me down, and there were times that I felt this really shouldn't have happened. This is something terrible. But I think anger is pointless. I give talks, and I'm usually a guest at sort of radicalization awareness network conferences and universities throughout Europe. And it really is all about reconciliation. Sometimes I'm at loggerheads with some other victims' groups because I really believe in dialogue. I don't think, without dialogue, you know, you hear people saying, you know, don't deal with terrorists. You have to. You have to.
What kept you going through the tough times, Stephen? The love of your wife, or do you also have faith?
My wife, without a shadow of a doubt, Anne has been the one constant in my life, I suppose I don't tell her often enough how important she is, you know. But I love her more today than I ever did, you know. And we had our 40th anniversary there last week.
Happy anniversary! And you have a daughter, of course. A lovely girl.
Our daughter is the greatest gift I ever got. Yeah, she's beautiful.
Stephen, thank you for coming in this morning and talking to me, because I know it's very difficult to go back on those times, and I wish you the very best of luck for the future.
It's my privilege, Miriam.
Thanks, Stephen.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.